Anya's head was swimming a little from the wine. She settled into bed. Georges had departed, slightly tipsy, but as professional as ever, in the company of Hassan and a couple other young men who looked capable of violence. Fiona had retired to her room, and Edmund was curled up asleep on the couch. Hassan had brought them their luggage a couple hours after their arrival and had stayed around for the wine. He had been watchful and intelligent, and Anya had recognized almost immediately that he was a street kid who paid attention. She had known kids like that while she'd been at the orphanage in New Orleans. Hassan, no matter where he was, West Africa or Paris, was a survivor. So was she. Dressed in gym shorts and a Yankees jersey, Anya opened up her computer. She dug into the alternative history websites, hoping for more information. Several of the entries were just basic information on the magic lanterns. A few focused on different illusionists scattered across 200 years of legerdemain. And there was even a flame war regarding Chris Angel's ability to do real magic.
Ni hao, lantern girl. Don't mind the two rockheads arguing above. Apparently, they didn't see Chris Angel's interview with Larry King when he said he didn't believe in magic. Sigh. Anyway, I was writing because the lantern you've got in this picture looks a lot like one I heard about while visiting one of my friends in Shanghai. Their family has some kind of legend about that lantern, about how they were disgraced by an ancestor or something. You know how big that is in Asian culture. I'm adding a picture of the lantern my friend's grandmother told me about. The pig is in black and white, and it's not very clear, but maybe this helps? No Shanghai girl.
A surge of excitement stirred Anya as she clicked on the attachment. The photograph was large, and it took a while to download, but when it had, the image was big enough to blow up and examine. At first blush, the lantern resembled the one Edmund had bought. Then again, all lanterns looked a lot alike.
Hang on.
What most interested Anya was the two men in the photograph. Neither of them was Anton de Tilleu. But they stood in front of a small building that had signs in the windows advertising banking in English, French, and Chinese. Her excitement grew. Sitting at the dining room table the next morning, Anya stared at her computer, studying the old Chinese picture. Fiona was already dressed for the day in pants and a loose pullover to cover her pistol. Anya glanced at the thick folder at Fiona's elbow. Georges had provided the information last night, and all of it concerned La Framboise and Puyi Jin. She had a digital copy of the same information on her computer hard drive. Fiona liked hard copy. Last night she had spread it out around her, looking at photographs and documents.
You think this is where Anton de Tilleu worked?
I don't know.
Doesn't really look like a bank, does it?
Well, banks didn't always look like banks back then. China was expanding, growing rapidly. It took time for construction to catch up.
You have to remember, Professor, Shanghai was a budding community back then. Trade was opening up along the Yangtze River. The customs office was moved to Shanghai from Songjiang in the 1730s.
1732. Sorry.
You must worry Rue to death with everything you know. He remembers events and people, but he's not one to keep dates in mind.
I didn't exactly know the date until I refreshed what I knew last night.
I truly don't know how your head can hold all that information without exploding.
Name the romantic poets.
William Blake, Lord Byron, William Wordsworth, Samuel Coleridge, Percy Bysshe Shelley, John Keats, Matthew Arnold, and John Clare. I get your point.
Where are we going to find La Framboise?
What do we know about him?
That he's a violent killer.
He made a momentous decision to betray a very dangerous enemy. He's also come into possession of an artifact that might possess magical properties. We know from his upbringing, from his mother's interest in the arcane, that La Framboise is a man given to a belief in the supernatural. His world has been turned upside down. So where would he go?
Getting out at all will be dangerous for him. He knows Puyi Jin is looking for him. The attack on Anya last evening would have told him that. The story was all over the news last night and this morning.
The danger is something La Framboise will accept, though. That's the price he pays for doing business. What is the biggest mystery on his hands at the moment?
The lantern.
Yes. Now that he has his hands on it, he'll want to know more about it. Where will he go?
A museum. Like me, he'll want to verify the authenticity of the lantern.
I mean no disrespect, Professor, but La Framboise would take the lantern to a museum or auction house only if he were interested in the financial value of the piece. He's not interested in that, is he?
No.
He's going to be more interested in the mystical aspects of the lantern.
And where is he going to go to find out about that?
Georges has listed 3 fortune tellers here in Paris that Laframboise sees on a regular basis.
None of them will be able to satisfy Laframboise, because whatever knowledge they have is going to be incomplete at best.
We have no way of knowing which one he'll see.
On the contrary, I think he's going to see them all. He has no choice.
Then we stake out these 3 people?
Georges has already put eyes on them. I asked him to do that last night.
So we're going to try to intercept Laframboise when he goes to see these people?
No. If we try to engage Laframboise in the streets, he'll be riding in an armored car. We won't be able to get at him.
Fiona rummaged through the file and pulled out an 8x10 of a luxury car, which she spun into the center of the table.
This is his vehicle. Top of the line and very well equipped.
Laframboise could always just have the fortune tellers come to him.
One of them does on a regular basis.
Fiona drew out another photograph, this one of a young man with intelligent eyes and thin lips.
He'll have to go to the other 2.
She laid their photographs out as well. The first was a stylishly dressed young African woman. The second was an older Asian woman whose face was gnarled in wrinkles and flecked with age spots. Her hazel eyes glittered in an otherworldly way.
The first is Magdalene de Brosse, a popular Parisian psychic. She has a network set up, phone lines and websites. She has a local television show and does private consulting in her office.
Fiona laid out another photograph on top of de Brosse's, a tall building in downtown Paris.
That building has considerable security and manpower. This is Bui Thi Trinh.
Vietnamese?
Yes.
I wasn't aware that the Vietnamese went much in for fortune-telling.
Every primitive people developed some sense of the supernatural to explain things. Back in the feudal era, the Vietnamese people believed in Thai Phu Thuy, sorcerers or witchmen. They set up small temples all over the country. They also believed in Âm Binh, ghost warriors that could cure disease or insanity, or cast love spells.
Interesting. Where does this woman operate?
In her flat. It's also interesting to note that this woman was one of those who taught Laframboise's mother fortune-telling.
So Laframboise's link to this one isn't just professional.
No.
Don't tell me we're going to go after this old woman.
No. She lives in a building that could be hard to get into and out of.
Fiona put Bui Thi Trinh's picture back into the folder.
We're going after the lantern when Laframboise goes to see Magdalene de Brosse.
I thought you said she worked out of a heavily secured office building.
She does. It'll make it more interesting, won't it?
Anya sat at a small table in an internet cafe across from the building where Magdalene de Brosse regularly delivered the future for her clientele. Jean-Baptiste Laframboise arrived a few minutes before noon, saving Anya the hassle of finding a new observation post. She'd been rotating locations with Fiona, cycling through the internet cafe across the street, a bistro half a block down, and a tourist shop on the bottom floor of the building. Across the street, Laframboise got out of his car while one of his bodyguards held the door. The man looked good, sleek and rested. Despite the solid hours of sleep she'd gotten the previous night, she still felt ragged and off. On the curb, Laframboise glanced around, spotted the window washers working on the 8th floor windows. Then he buttoned his coat and nodded to his bodyguard. The big man took the lead toward the building, and Laframboise followed. 2 more bodyguards came after him. One of them carried a case slightly larger than Dutilleux's lantern. Magdalene de Brosse operated out of a small office on the 6th floor. According to the information Georges had provided, the fortune teller's day began promptly at 8 o'clock and was over by 5 p.m. Clients came and went every 30 minutes and stayed no longer than 20 minutes, unless they made special arrangements, and that was expensive. Georges's information on the fortune teller was extensive. Some of the background came from a man Georges knew inside the Paris police. De Brosse and her operation had been under investigation for some time, but none of the law enforcement people had found anything incriminating. The woman claimed to deliver glimpses of the future, and she never took more money than she charged for her time. Anya lifted the disposable phone Georges had given her to use. She punched in the number for Fiona, who was currently inside the tourist shop.
Yes?
He's here.
Anya watched La Framboise pass through the building's double glass doors and into the foyer.
I have him. We know where he's going.
I'm on my way.
Anya got up from the chair at the table. She popped the phone's earpiece in her ear and pocketed the cell, leaving the connection in place. Out on the street, La Framboise's car pulled into traffic and glided away. There was a parking garage two blocks away. Georges had assumed the driver would take the car there, or he would simply circle the block until La Framboise reemerged. Either way would keep the man out of play. In the foyer across the street, La Framboise and his retinue stood waiting for the elevator to arrive. Fiona was nowhere in sight. Outside the internet cafe, Anya pulled her jacket a little tighter against the wind and walked to the corner to cross. She wore a black wig and wraparound sunglasses that dramatically altered her features.
He's going up to six.
Anya hadn't met the young technical wizard Georges had provided for their recovery effort, except to speak briefly by phone that morning. The tech spy had hacked into the building's closed-circuit television system, which monitored all the public areas, the hallways, and the elevators. When the light changed, Anya strode across the street with the other pedestrians. She wore cargo pants and a t-shirt with a loose shirt and a jacket to cover the pistol at the small of her back. She didn't want to have to rely on the gun. She also wore thin gloves so she wouldn't leave prints on the weapon.
He's arrived at six.
Very good. What about his associates?
They're with him.
Let me know if there's any deviation.
Of course.
She entered the building's lobby. A uniformed security guard stood at his post with a magazine in one hand and a cup of coffee in the other. Fiona fell into step with Anya, and they reached the elevator together. She'd changed her appearance also, adding a long brown wig and different makeup. Anya watched the elevator numbers drop lower as they neared the lobby.
Are you ready for this?
As ready as I can be.
I always get nervous right before we get down to it.
I thought you were born for stuff like this.
I just put on a good show.
Yes, you do.
They were the only two people to get on.
Are you still with us, Heimdall? I feel ridiculous using that sobriquet.
I see everything. No evil shall escape my sight.
You're mixing your comic book cultures. Heimdall is from the Norse mythology, and Thor is published by Marvel Comics. The bit about no evil is from Green Lantern's Oath, a DC Comics thing.
Depends on your point of view. It's all Hollywood to me. Idris Elba and Ryan Reynolds. And how do you know so much about comics?
I'm a big reader.
You do surprise, Anya Creed.
Fiona readied her pistol and reholstered it. The elevator went past the sixth floor and stopped at the seventh. The plan was to take the stairs back down to six. Magdalene DeBrosse's office was near the corner.
Guys, we have a problem.
Just outside the stairwell door leading to the sixth floor, Anya came to a halt and looked at Fiona. The other woman drew her pistol from the folds of her jacket. Anya reached for the sword and felt it with her fingers, but didn't pull it into the stairwell.
What problem, Heimdall?
Fiona peered through the wire mesh window that looked into the hallway. Anya leaned in beside her. Only a short distance away, a lone guard stood at the entrance to Magdalene DeBrosse's suite, which they'd expected. The two other guards and La Framboise had to be inside.
The psychic woman has just called the police. I took the liberty of tapping her phone lines as a precaution.
Why did she call the police?
There's some trouble in the office.
What trouble?
I'm looking. The psychic rents the room behind her office as well.
A bolt hole?
Yes. I'm checking through the security footage. Late last night, a group of Chinese men entered that office. They haven't come out.
Then we have to assume we aren't the only ones who know about Magdalene DeBrosse's second room. Can you identify the men?
I've downloaded images of them, but I don't have access to those kinds of databases.
Understood. I have a chap who could take care of the identification.
At the sound of gunfire from within, the guard outside drew his weapon and charged.
Well, that's a sure indication that things have gone awry. The second room is just around the way?
Yes.
Since our quarry hasn't come back through this door, let's assume he, or someone, is going to come through the other one.
Fiona started running toward the intersection of hallways only a short distance ahead of her. Anya was a step behind Fiona as they rounded the next corner that took them to the hallway where the door to Magdalene DeBrosse's second room was.
I've got your target.
Where?
Ahead of you, on your right.
Staring ahead, Anya spotted the Asian man just stepping out of a doorway less than 10 feet away. Just before she asked Heimdall for further clarification, She spotted the familiar case tucked under the man's arm. When the man pulled up a pistol, he removed all doubt as to his identity. He swung the case up as Fiona fired. The bullet ricocheted off the reinforced case and dug into a nearby wall. Never breaking stride, Anya drew the sword into the hallway with her.
Yeah!
Anya swung at the man's pistol, smacking it from his hand as he stared at the sword in surprise.
What you yell? My food!
He raised the case to block another sword strike and backed away. Four men rounded the corner at the far end of the hallway and opened fire at once. Fiona flung herself into a doorway and fired from cover. One of the men sagged with a bullet between his eyes, followed by the man next to him. Brandishing her sword, Anya focused on the Asian man with the lantern case. She swung at his head, but the man spun, blocking her sword with the case. He came around with a back kick that caught her in the middle of her chest. As she fell back, the man spun again, lashing out with a foot and sweeping her legs out from under her. Releasing her hold on the sword, she slammed against the floor. The man loomed above her. He raised his foot, and she knew he intended to drive it through her face. Reaching up, Anya caught the man's foot, stopping his boot sole only an inch or two from her nose. Anya wrenched her opponent's foot. He came crashing down, arms windmilling, and he lost his hold on the case. Anya rolled out of the way, pushed herself to her feet, and grabbed the handle of the case.
No!
The man scrambled to get up, but his wrenched ankle betrayed him. He crumpled to his knee. He lunged for the pistol, but Anya got there first and kicked the weapon away. Fiona narrowed her opponents down to one. This one holed up around the corner at the end of the hall in another corridor. Fiona took refuge in the recessed doorway and calmly reloaded her weapon. She took note of Anya.
You got the case. Good job. Let's get out of here.
Anya headed toward the opposite end of the hallway. Another corridor ran perpendicular to the one they were in. If she had the floor configuration worked out, there was another emergency stairwell and a set of elevators there. Fiona took another shot at the man around the corner, then turned the pistol toward the man Anya had fought. Before Fiona could pull the trigger, La Framboise yanked open the door the Asian man had come through. Another man with a machine pistol stood at his side.
Fiona!
Effortlessly, Fiona wheeled around and fired at the open door. Both men dove back inside the room as splinters ripped from the door.
Damn.
Fiona dropped the empty magazine, pulling still another from her jacket and slamming it home as she ran to join Anya.
The crossfire is not where we need to be!
Anya ran after her. Bullets cut the air around them and punched holes in the wall at the end of the hallway. At the end of the hallway, Anya started to go right toward the second set of stairs and elevators. But another group of armed Asians was sprinting toward them.
Well, this isn't where we want to be either.
Fiona's fire scattered the new arrivals. Retreating the other way, Anya ran hard and Fiona kept pace close behind.
Heimdall, is the other stairwell and elevator back clear?
Negative. You guys are boxed. I'm sorry. I'll call our friend. Perhaps there's something he can do. The police are on their way.
Fiona drew up alongside Anya, and they ducked around another turn in the hallway. This one left them facing a wall of glass that looked out over Paris. Fiona stood at attention beside Anya.
You don't think they'd be willing to surrender, do you?
No.
I didn't think so either. But it's only because they don't know what they're up against. For the moment, they're distracted by each other. But they'll get round to us soon enough. I'm down to my last magazine. And to be frightfully honest, I don't think either La Framboise or Polygin's group intends to let us survive this.
A flicker of movement on the other side of the window distracted Anya from the dark thoughts that crowded her mind. When she saw the second snake-like flicker slide across the glass, recognition dawned. She rushed over to see. There, outside the window, the suspended scaffold she'd spotted earlier hung a floor below them and to one side, perhaps 8 feet away. Two men dragged squeegees across the windows with iPod earbuds in their ears. Anya turned to Fiona.
How do you feel about heights?
We're on the sixth floor. Jumping is not an option.
It's the only option we have.
Fiona joined her at the window and peered down at the window washer rig.
Oh, bloody hell. Surely you're joking.
We're all out of places to run to.
Anya stepped back from the window and drew her pistol. Thin cracks that looked like spiderwebs spread out from the bullet hole, but the glass clung stubbornly to its moorings. Anya set down the lantern case and reached for one of the spare magazines she carried. Just as she slammed it home, the glass sucked out of the window and broke apart, leaving the space relatively empty. The pieces glittered as they sailed across the street. Mostly, they rained down over the sidewalk as pedestrians ran for cover. No one was hurt. Anya holstered her weapon and picked up the case. Below, the window washers looked up at the broken window and spotted Anya. They plucked the earbuds out of their ears and stood waiting. At the sound of gunfire, they dropped down. Anya acted quickly, climbing into the window. She barely maintained her balance against the sucking pull of the wind and the sense of vertigo as she stared down at the street far below. She hefted the lantern case and brought it in close to her body. Anya flung herself toward the nearest cable supporting the washing rig. She clamped her hand around the wire rope and the rigid surface bit into her palm. Maintaining her grip, she wrapped her leg around the rope as well, and then released her hand and wrapped the rope inside her elbow to protect her fingers. Holding on, able to somewhat control her descent, she slid down until her foot reached the scaffold's safety rail. The wind caught her again. She fought it and dropped onto the scaffold. The men stared at her in shock. Driven by Anya's landing, the scaffold swung sickeningly.
Mademoiselle!
Ignoring them, Anya set the case down and turned to look up at Fiona. The woman stood at the window and gazed down.
Fiona! Just get the timing and jump! Wrap your arms and legs around the cable. Don't try to hold on with your hands.
Cautiously, swaying with the wind, Fiona climbed into the window frame and gathered herself. Without a word, she leaped toward the scaffold. Fiona wrapped her arms and legs around the wire rope and slid, but she came too fast. Her legs shot past the scaffolding, and her grip with her arms was slipping.
It's okay. I've got you. Just hang on.
The scaffold swayed and banged against the windows, jarring Anya as she pulled. Before she could get Fiona onto the scaffold, an Asian gunman thrust his head and shoulders through the window above. He pointed his pistol and fired. The scaffold's wild swings and the wind shear hammering the gunman made them a harder target, but it was only a matter of time. Fiona released her grip on Anya's arm with her right hand and drew her pistol. Anya set herself and yanked again. Fiona's bullet slapped into the man's chest. The wind caught him and sucked him out the window. Anya pulled Fiona onto the scaffold and fell onto her haunches. Fiona rolled and contorted, then got into a crouched position with her pistol braced on the scaffold's safety railing for support. Searching the scaffold, Anya spotted the control panel. The directions were simple and in French, but there was another problem. She looked at the men.
Will the scaffold reach the ground?
Second floor. It will go to the second floor. Perhaps a little farther.
Thank you.
Anya pressed the button, and the scaffold started dropping slowly.
Heimdall, are you still with us?
Yes. I thought you were dead when you jumped out of that window.
Have the car brought around. There's an alley on the west side of the building.
A Bayomi will be there. Don't worry.
Can this go any faster?
The lever!
The man pointed to the control panel. Spotting it, Anya threw the lever to its limit. The scaffold dropped almost as fast as an elevator. 50 yards away, white Peugeot cars with police on the sides in red and blue screeched to a stop in front of the building. Pedestrians ringed the dead man on the sidewalk only a few yards away. So far, no one was paying particular attention to the window washing scaffold. Reaching the end of its tether, the scaffold swung 6 or 7 feet from the ground.
I'm sorry. This is as far as it goes.
That's fine. Thank you.
Will you be going now?
Yes.
Anya grabbed the lantern case and clambered over the side of the scaffold, which was still swinging, though less so now that it had come to a stop. Several pedestrians stared as Anya heaved herself over the side of the scaffold and dropped to the sidewalk. Fiona dropped into place beside her.
Well, that certainly was an adventure. Is it like this for you all the time? More often than not. Does Rue accompany you much? No. I didn't think so. I believe the life you lead is perhaps a little too exciting even for his tastes. It's a little too exciting for mine. I'm your creed. I don't think that's exactly true. There's a certain glow about you that I see when we're under fire, or jumping from tall buildings.
One of the policemen came toward them, then saw the dead man lying on the pavement. He clicked his shoulder radio, and more policemen came running with their guns drawn. Anya and Fiona shoved through the pedestrians and then broke into a full run, making for the alley. Anya hoped like hell the car would be there. When they arrived, the alley was empty. She came to a stop and looked around.
Heimdall? Patience. He's almost there.
Three uniformed police officers had pursued Anya and Fiona.
You two, hold it there! We want to talk to you!
The police officers drew back as a vehicle bore down on them.
Stop! Stop the car!
Stop it did. right beside Anya and Fiona, Edmund flung the door open.
Get in!
Anya and Fiona wasted no time sliding in. The police officers gave chase on foot, but none of them fired their weapons. The driver, Abayomi, was a young West African who wore his multicolored hair in dreadlocks. He wheeled out onto the next street and churned through traffic. Edmund stared at the case.
You got the lantern.
Now we get to see what secrets it holds.
Two hours later, back in the safe house Georges had provided, Anya had to admit she was stumped. If the lantern had any secrets, the array of chemicals and powders she'd used on it failed to coax them out. The bronze dragon held on to the lens in its mouth, as well as any secrets it had. Fiona and Edmund sat across from her at the dining table.
Is there anything at all you can tell us about the lantern?
No more than I've already told you. The lantern is authentic, handmade, at least 300 years old. That's all I've learned.
No secret markings? No hidden code?
None that I can find.
But that doesn't make sense.
I know.
There has to be something.
The only discrepancy I've found is in the lens placement.
The fact that there are three grooves for the lens in the dragon's mouth, I'd already noticed that.
Do you know why they're there?
To focus the lens better during projection. Probably marked off for different distances, depending on the image.
The lens in the dragon's mouth isn't the original, is it?
No, that was too much to ask for.
Anya popped the lens from the dragon's mouth. It didn't come out easily.
I got the best fit I could. I intended to have the lens ground to a better size at a later date, once I decided what to have painted on the lens.
What were you considering?
A black and white image of Anton Dutilleux. Nothing terribly imaginative, I'm afraid.
Anya tried the lens on the other grooves and couldn't get it to fit. She finally surrendered and placed it back in the original groove.
Men have been killed over that lantern, and not just lately. 200 years ago, Anton Dutilleux was killed for it. There has to be something.
I know.
It could well be that the treasure, whatever it is already gone.
I simply can't believe that we've gone through all this for nothing.
Not every mystery gets solved. Not every treasure gets found. Imagine how disappointed La Framboise and Puyi Jin are going to be.
They're not going to believe the treasure doesn't exist. They're still going to hunt us, aren't they?
Unless we can stop them or make them believe it doesn't exist.
That's going to be hard to do, I'm afraid. Now that we've had the lantern in our hands, even if we give it back, they'll assume we already figured out whatever secret was there. We're dealing with greedy men.
Getting the lantern didn't help as much as I thought it would.
In one respect, no, it didn't. However, we have definitely set La Framboise and Puyi Jin at each other's throats, so that should buy us some time. Otherwise, either of them could have pursued you, Professor.
Perhaps we should go to the police at this point. After all, it is me those two want. Me and the lantern, actually. If I were to turn myself over to the police, they could provide protection, and the two of you would be left out of this whole sorry mess.
I must apologize. I'm not very polite, am I? The police have their uses, Professor, but they're not so good when it comes to protecting individuals.
But as long as I'm with you, I'm putting you in danger.
Anya and I are adults, perfectly capable of making our own decisions. We involved ourselves. We could have let you go hang, after all, instead of showing up to rescue you.
I'm awfully glad you didn't.
Of course you are. You need to have a little faith and let us work through this situation. Now, we can kill La Framboise and Puyi Jin, or we can solve the riddle of the lantern. The first option will, of course, take some time, but it can be managed. I have my resources, and given the base nature of our opponents, I am not without resolve. After all we've been through, I am certainly motivated. On the other hand, no pressure, Anya dear. Solving the riddle could be faster and would certainly incur less bloodshed and police interest than my alternative.
I know. Let me have some time.
Of course. We're perfectly safe here for the moment. You tend to your investigations, and I'll see to things on my end.
Anya took the lantern and her backpack, then headed to her room. 3 hours later, Anya sat cross-legged and short of temper on the small bed in her room. She stared at the lantern, perfectly balanced on the bed. The dragon looked like it was perched and ready to leap out at her.
Try it. Just give me any excuse. Talking to the artifact. That's not good. Threatening it is even worse.
Carefully, she got up, put the lantern back in its case, and headed out into the living area. The television was on, replaying a story about the shootout at the office building. She'd already seen the footage. So far, La Framboise and Pu Yijin had been mentioned, but no one had dropped Anya's or Fiona's names. Magdalene de Brosse had stated that thieves had broken into her office and stolen the object La Framboise had brought her. No fingers had been pointed, but Anya knew the fortune teller was more involved than she was letting on. Pu Yijin's men hadn't found the second room by accident. La Framboise had been set up, and he must now know it. Although La Framboise would probably only face minor charges for his part in the incident, the fallout should be sufficiently distracting to afford them a little breathing room. Edmund sat on the couch with a deck of cards. He made them disappear and reappear with a mechanical repetition. His eyes were unfocused, unseeing, and he didn't notice Anya until she stepped directly in front of him.
Going somewhere?
Rooftop. I need to clear my head. Where's Fiona?
She went out with Georges. They're up to something, but she didn't say what. What's on the rooftop?
Peace of mind, I hope.
You still haven't gotten anywhere with... Of course you haven't, otherwise you'd say.
I would.
Are you going to be all right on your own?
Yes. In the meantime, why don't you look back through the Dutilleux material? See if there's some new angle. Anything.
What should I look for?
If I knew, I'd tell you. Hopefully we've missed something. We need a new trail.
Glumly, Edmund nodded and reached for his computer. Anya went down the hallway to the fire escape. The window was unlocked. Out she went. Anya looked out over the city. She started slowly, limbering up her body with stretches, then falling naturally into martial arts katas. After a few minutes, she reached for the sword and pulled it onto the rooftop with her. She whirled and danced, feinted and struck, blocked and counterstruck. The blade was a part of her, an extension of her. Continuing her workout, a fine sheen of sweat covered her and cooled her body. Her mind became quiet and free. She mentally studied the dragon lantern, turning it over and over and around.
The secret is incomplete, of course. But how is the lantern incomplete? The missing lens? That's one way. But is there another? There's something there. I can sense it. All I have to do is grasp it.
Anya had the immediate impression she should answer her phone. She came to a stop with the ease of a leaf falling and was suddenly at rest. Holding the sword in her right hand, she fished her sat phone from her cargo pants.
Hello?
Just checking in. How's it going with the magic lantern?
I've got it.
That's great, Anya! You haven't used up all the wishes, have you? Because we had an agreement. You know, a wish each and then...
I remember. I'm afraid I haven't figured out how to get it to work yet.
That's cool. We'll get there. We just gotta find the instructions.
Thanks, Doug. I'll call you back.
Ooh, wait!
Anya closed the phone and tucked it back into her pocket. When she turned to face the fire escape, she spotted Fiona sitting there, watching.
How long have you been there?
I honestly couldn't tell you. Long enough to tell that you and that sword were made for each other. I've never seen anything like that. Was that dancing?
I don't know. It's just natural when I'm with the sword.
Don't be embarrassed. That was one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. And I can tell you, I've seen some beautiful things.
Thank you. I just realized that we missed something. Is Edmund still downstairs?
Poring over his records of Anton Dutilleux when I left him.
I've got to talk to him.
Maybe you shouldn't take that sword. He might get the wrong impression.
Smiling ruefully, but no less excited, Anya released the sword. When they returned to the flat, Edmund was on the phone.
Yes, of course. No, this is very important. Those things should have been together. No, I'm not placing any blame on you. Do forgive me if I sounded that way. It was not intended. Please let me know what you find out.
You sound like you've had an epiphany, Professor.
That would be putting a happy face on it. No, I've made a dunderheaded mistake is what I've done. Anya, do you know what I missed?
There were papers in the auction lot with Anton Dutilleux's magic lantern. Papers that had belonged to Dutilleux.
That's right. It came to me as I went back through the item list from the auction I attended that the lantern might not have been the only thing Dutilleux left behind. There was an assortment of magic books, and I did acquire all those, but, as it turns out, there was a diary.
But it wasn't his.
You're more magician than I am. How are you coming up with this?
Tell me about the diary.
What? Don't you already know?
It's written in Chinese.
Perhaps I should venture up to the rooftop as well.
And so?
The sellers were going to list the lantern and the diary together. Those items, after all, were discovered together. But they had no way of knowing that Anton Dutilleux had ever owned the diary. In fact, I was only guessing that he might have. I was looking for anything written that had been in that lot. The sellers thought they might get more money offering the lantern and the diary separately, but it should have occurred to me.
You went there looking for the lantern.
I did. Once I'd heard of it and of its possible history, I'm afraid that was all I could think of. Tunnel vision on my part.
Well, why would you have wanted a diary written in Chinese and probably not even written by Dutilleux?
True. There was nothing in his past that mentioned his knowledge of written Chinese. Though, in retrospect, given his employment history as a banking employee in Shanghai, I should have at least considered that.
Tell me about the diary.
Not much to tell, I'm afraid. It popped up with a lantern when Robertson's assistant's things were found in an old boarding house 3 months ago, and is listed as having belonged to Dutilleux. But that's all that's really known about it.
No one's had it translated?
No one's cared to. It's over 200 years old. The sellers figured that whatever was in the pages of that diary surely weren't of interest to anyone in this day and age. They thought it was a keepsake. Nothing more. Possibly a volume of Chinese literature or a family history.
It may yet be that.
I suppose. But Anton Dutilleux wasn't the kind of man who would travel all the way from the Orient carrying useless things.
Where is the diary now?
It was sold. I asked the sellers for the name of the person who bought it. They're not in the habit of disclosing information. But I pointed out that Jean-Baptiste Laframboise certainly got hold of my information.
Did they admit to that?
Not even. But it cut some difference with them. They're certainly more receptive to the idea of putting me in touch with the purchaser.
Perhaps I can be of assistance.
Of course you can.
I'll put Ollie on it right now. I'll just need the particulars of that sale, if you please, Professor.
Fiona took out her sat phone. Anya felt restless as she waited for Ollie to discover who currently had the Dutilleux diary, so she busied herself with work on the Mr. Hyde investigation back in London. Detective Chief Inspector Westcox was all over the internet and conventional media as the subject of interviews, discussion, and speculation. There seemed to be no end of buzz around the killer's possible identity and the helplessness of the London Metro Police Department to get their man. The victim's photographs online were grisly, spurring Anya's urge to help somehow.
You're not a detective. You're an archaeologist. Westcox will find the murderer. He's good at that sort of thing. If there was something in that investigation you could help with, you would.
Meanwhile, Mr. Hyde continued to taunt the police. He'd written in twice more, claiming victory, that they wouldn't catch him, and that he would kill again. Soon.
Why so pensive?
Fiona stood in the doorway.
I'm sorry. I didn't hear you come in.
No wonder. What with the material you're looking at?
I shouldn't be. Keeping up with all of that just makes me feel useless.
Those murders aren't something you can do anything about.
I've been reminding myself of that.
Have you always felt the need to be responsible for people?
What do you mean?
Most individuals wouldn't take on what you do, Anya. If they met someone like Edmund Beswick, they would have felt badly for him and wished him well. But that sense of responsibility would have ended there.
Maybe.
There's no maybe to it. You stepped right into that young professor's battle without an instant's hesitation.
Seems to me you did the same thing.
Not so. I took you on at the express request of an old friend. You hardly knew the professor. Not the same thing at all. Furthermore, I'm in the business of dealing with other people's troubles. You are an archaeologist.
And a television personality.
I don't believe for an instant that being a television personality was ever an ambition of yours. What I have to wonder, though, and I am concerned, is how much that sword influences your judgment.
What do you mean?
I think it pushes you to help others rather more than you would if left to your own devices.
Couldn't I just be a good person?
I wouldn't think you could be anything else. But I saw you with that sword up on the rooftop. It was like...
Like you and that sword are in a relationship. I know about the darkness and some of the artifacts that Rue searches out. And perhaps that sword carries some trouble with it as well.
I don't believe that.
At least consider the possibility. The bad situations you're drawn into might be brought on by that sword. Indeed, perhaps the sword doesn't push you toward these troubles, but rather draws them to you.
I've thought about that, Fiona. But I'm more of the opinion that, if anything, the sword simply lets me see the bad things that are happening. There's no forced involvement. The choice is mine.
I hope that's true.
Let me ask you a question.
Of course.
You searched for the sword with Rue, even found a few of the pieces. Mightn't that search and the contact you had with those sword fragments somehow influence you and what you're choosing to do?
That sword was put here to change the life of one young woman.
I've met several people whose lives have been changed because I was able to help them.
Touché.
Did you just come up here to offer advice?
To pry, you mean?
If I thought you were prying, you wouldn't have gotten a word out of me. I was raised by nuns. I know how to keep my mouth shut.
You are a treat, Anya. I can see why Rue is drawn to you.
I don't think drawn is the word he would use. The last conversation I had with him, I called him an asshat.
I wish I had been there.
He can be a real jerk sometimes.
Yes, he can. Rue is only a man, after all. Living proof that even a man of 500 years or more is limited in what he can learn. I came up here to let you know. Ollie has located the missing diary.
Night had fallen over Paris. The glow of the City of Lights pulsed against the windows of the flat as Anya took a seat on the couch beside Edmund. She hadn't realized how late it had become. Fiona sat on the other side of Edmund. The professor's computer was open on the coffee table, displaying Ollie Wemyss, as immaculate and unflappable as ever, center stage in Fiona's office back in London. The view showed him from the waist up, and Anya was certain the man had staged it.
Good evening, Miss Creed.
Hello, Ollie.
As I was telling Miss Pioche and Professor Beswick, I have had a bit of luck locating the contents of the diary you people are looking for.
Wait, the contents of the diary?
Yes, you see, there was a problem with the diary. At about the time Professor Beswick went missing, and La Framboise's people were breaking into his storage unit, with Pu Yi Jin's people vectoring in at that moment as well, all very exciting, the purchaser of the diary had her house burgled. The diary appears to have been the target of the invasion.
Was the woman harmed?
No. Fortunately, she was out of the house when the theft occurred.
Then how did you end up with the contents?
Miss Creed, when you're about to deliver a lecture, do you allow the audience to pester you with questions which you plan to answer in their proper due course at the outset?
I apologize.
We'll have time for the Q&A afterward. As I said, the original document was lost. Whatever secrets might be in the architecture of the book itself, I'm afraid, are beyond us at this point. Though I am told the new owner had checked the volume quite thoroughly. Mrs. Rollison, quite an invigorating old bird, and I use that as a term of endearment, took it upon herself to photocopy all of the pages. She found me absolutely charming when I presented myself on her doorstep and asked after the diary. I had to endure a lot of cheek-pinching, but I persuaded her to part with a copy of her computer file. I'm sending it along now through the FTP site Professor Beswick has accessed. Since Mrs. Rollison is quite the expert in Chinese written language across the ages, and a suitable translator will take some time to locate, even with my connections, I also got her to share her partial translation with us. She's still working on the document.
Even though you're quite taken with Mrs. Rollison and her translation abilities, I'd like to have the translation double-checked.
Seriously, Miss Pioche?
Sometimes, Ollie, dear though you are to me, you are insufferable.
How very magnanimous and eloquent of you. I've currently got the document with two other learned souls who shall get back to me forthwith because I bribed them heavily with your money. Since you're a woman of means, I saw no reason not to get the best available.
I trust they're working independently as well?
Definitely.
How long will their translations take?
Days, I'm afraid, but since time is of the essence, I asked them to work the diary backward, believing that the last entries would be the most beneficial.
Thank you, Ollie.
I live only to serve, Miss Pioche. From the pages Miss Rollison has translated, the diary belonged to a man named Tsai Chen Fu. At the time of the writing, he was a Chinese official working for the Shanghai banks in the late 1790s.
Looks like we're back in the race.
I don't want to dim your spirits, but I would like to put things in perspective for you. Mrs. Rollison has been quite diligent in her translation, and I gave it a read-through as I was preparing to send it to you. There is no mention of a treasure. Sai Qian Fu appears to have been a very thorough Chinese bureaucrat working for the Emperor, and quite boring.
But is there any mention of Anton de Tilleu?
As it turns out, Miss Pioche, there is. Sai Qian Fu worked with Anton de Tilleu.
For over an hour, Edmund's computer downloaded the graphic-intensive files through the server. As each page of the diary came through, he printed it out and sent it to Anya's computer so they could all look at the work being done. Most of the reading was dry material. Sai Qian Fu wrote mostly about the day-to-day business of Shanghai banking as he learned it. He was fastidious in his recollections of the people he met and the transactions that were made. Sitting at the table, Fiona leafed through the pages of translation she'd been passed. Anya kept her focus on the images on her computer, blowing up the characters and searching for hidden meanings. It was mostly wasted effort on her part, though, because she couldn't read Chinese and only had the barest acquaintance with the characters.
Typical bureaucratic documentation.
At the time Du Tilleu was there, the empire was ruled by Qian Lung, a man known to be very conservative and ungenerous. Tsai had every reason to make sure he had a separate record of what he was doing in case the Emperor's accountants took his books.
This isn't going to help us much.
Fiona held up a printout. Anya looked at the paper.
Tsai seemed quite enamored of Du Tilleu, though.
When's that from?
October 22nd, 1790. This details how the two of them met.
Edmund consulted a small notepad.
Du Tilleu was in Shanghai from 1786 to 1792. He went to work at the Shanghai Bank in 1790.
So the two of them met in 1790, and 2 years later, Du Tilleu left. Did he have another job offer?
No. He returned to Paris and began his career in magic.
He didn't have much time to work on it.
On the contrary, Du Tilleu was a magician before he went over to Shanghai. He just didn't have his act together. Before then, he'd toured the small Parisian theaters, but didn't have much success. He took the accounting job in Shanghai to avoid debtor's prison. Over the next few years, he was able to pay off his creditors and sharpen his craft.
Tsai was quite impressed with Du Tilleu's sleight of hand. In some of these references, Tsai calls Du Tilleu Shang.
I know barely enough Chinese to get by over there, but that's one word I do know. The literal translation is magician, or wizard, or shaman, among other things. But if Tsai was calling Du Tilleu Shan, I'd be willing to assume that's why he did.
Tilting the paper, Fiona started searching.
All right, if we now know that Shan was a pet name for Du Tilleu, then this later part makes more sense.
She handed papers over to Anya.
In this section, Tsai refers to putting all his hope into the Shan.
The translator could have inferred the article. Tsai might have been referring to Du Tilleu.
Do you know when Du Tilleu left Shanghai to return to Paris?
July 15th.
On this page, Tsai talks about how the Shan carried all the seeds of his family's future to more fertile pastures. This is dated July 15, and if memory serves me correctly, that corresponds with the Chinese Hungry Ghost Festival, the traditional day the deceased are believed to visit the living. By all accounts, a most singular day.
Then perhaps there's reason to believe that Du Tilleu stole nothing. Whatever treasure he was carrying was something he got from Tsai.
There's still the question of what happened to Tsai. Tsai's diary goes on for 5 more weeks, then stops abruptly. The last few entries are filled with his concern that the Emperor's men have discovered what he has done, and that they are going to kill him. He goes on to say that they didn't know Shan was already gone. Anya, you said that some of the information you had dug up indicated that Qianlong Emperor's men were searching for Du Tilleu?
Yes. According to this, there was a theft from the royal treasury. Several bank employees were executed.
Was Tsai one of them?
It doesn't say, but the time frame appears right. We need to find out what happened to Tsai Qian Fu.
Yes, Ale? All right. Give me the URL. Got it. Thanks, Ale. Ale has something for us to look at online. He says he got lucky and got video footage of the break-in at the Rollison home.
Anya quickly typed the address into her computer and waited as the site came up. A black-and-white video image showed men getting out of a nondescript sedan in front of what Anya assumed was the apartment building where Mrs. Rollison lived. The scene cut, then opened up again on a hallway view of the three men as they broke into a flat. This time, the camera revealed that they were Asian. They returned 17 minutes later carrying a box. The time lapse sped up to get through the waiting.
We have to believe the diary is in Pu Yijin's hands now. He could well be caught up with us at this point.
Then he'll probably be looking for Cai Chenfu as well. We'll just have to find him faster.
Consumed by her mission, Anya worked through the night. The Cai family name was one of the less common in China, and the country had a lot of genealogical documentation despite the wars and unrest that had torn it apart at different times. Anya had hoped the name would be enough to help her find Cai Chenfu. It wasn't. She failed and failed again, to the point of wanting to put her computer through the wall. In the end, it was the alt.history site that pointed the way. At 5:53 a.m., a new posting came through from New Shanghai Girl. At Anya's request, the young woman had investigated her friend's family.
Ni hao again, Lantern Girl. I'm glad my posting helped you find what you were looking for. Wouldn't it be cool if your lantern was the same one my friend's family had lost? Or if the two lanterns were somehow related? I mean, I know there are probably a million dragon lanterns, but this one's gotta be special, right? Anyway, my friend's family still lives in the same place. They own a flower shop in Nanqiao Town, the largest city in the Fengxian district. The shop's name translates to beautiful moon petals, which has got to be one of the corniest names I've ever heard of. Her father's name is Li Shusen, or Shusen Li if you want to write it in English. But my friend's mother's maiden name was Cai, which I think is the name of the man in the picture. The Chinese one, not the European one. LOL. My friend's name is Guifang, but we call her Amy. Can I tell her that you may have found her family's long-lost lantern? Gotta go. I have a paper due in anthropology tomorrow. New Shanghai Girl.
Ni hao, New Shanghai Girl. Don't mention this to your friend yet. I'm planning on coming to Shanghai soon and can arrange a meeting. Maybe it'll be a great surprise. I appreciate all your help. Lantern Girl.
About an hour later, Fiona and Edmund had rejoined Anya at the dining table.
You're still in your clothing from yesterday. Did you sleep at all?
No, but I think I found the Cai family.
Truly?
Yes.
Anya told them the story of her discovery.
Are you planning on contacting the Li family and finding out if they are indeed the family we're looking for?
By phone? I don't think we could get the answers we need by doing this over the phone. I think we need to go there.
Actually, I agree. This is something that will be best handled in person.
Wait, you're seriously talking about just jetting over to Shanghai?
Of course.
You do realize there are people looking for us?
Not a thing we're likely to forget, given the nature of our arrival and all the trouble we got into yesterday.
Oh, how do you plan on getting out of Paris? La Framboise and possibly Pu Yijin will know about your private jet by now.
After the debacle that occurred at the airport, I had the pilot take my jet back to London, not wanting La Framboise or Pu Yijin targeting the jet just for spite. I'm certain Georges can find us a way to Shanghai. He does business with that side of the world as well.
How soon can we leave?
Let me give Georges a ring, but I'm willing to bet we can leave fairly quickly.
Georges reacted a lot more quickly than Anya could have imagined. Within an hour of getting Fiona's call, he had a flight available for them aboard a cargo jet that would be flying non-stop. They had to hurry to pack and to get to the airport on time. Georges drove them himself and talked with the flight crew to make sure everything was in order. He stood at the loading gate and talked with Fiona as the plane was prepped for departure.
Everything will be in order for the customs people when you arrive in Shanghai.
Georges handed Fiona a thick manila envelope.
I've provided paperwork that will show all of you as consultants for an investment business that I'm associated with in Shanghai.
Doing a bit of piracy, are you?
You've got a suspicious nature, Miss Pioche.
Only when I'm around suspicious people.
Rest assured, the business I'm doing with these people will not reflect on you. Your trip should be uneventful, and I'll keep hoping that you find whatever it is you're looking for.
Thank you, Georges. You've been very kind.
Your presence always reinvigorates whatever poor kindness resides within me. I do wish you'd have been able to stay longer. I would love to take you to dinner.
I would have enjoyed that as well. But that would be best enjoyed when someone isn't gunning for me.
True.
I'll see you again soon, Georges.
As Georges had promised, their passage through the China inspection and quarantine was relatively uneventful. It was now almost 7, too early yet to go calling on the Li family. There was still over an hour of travel time to reach Nanchiao Town. Once they had cleared customs, Fiona led the way to the Avis car rental area. And Fiona surprised Anya by speaking fluent Chinese.
You can speak Mandarin?
I can speak it, but I can't read it. I came here a number of times with Rue. There were all kinds of interesting things we found while we were in this country.
I didn't think you could rent a car here. The last time I tried, I was told I had to have a Chinese driver's license and that it took about 3 weeks to get one.
I have a Chinese driver's license.
Fiona took the document from the small handbag she carried.
And it's up to date. As I've said, I've been here a number of times, and I still have business that brings me here on occasion. Having a license is just smart.
You're amazing.
I've had an amazing life, as I'm sure you're going to have. The trick is to always manage to survive.
At the car rental agency, they picked up a gray Volkswagen Passat. Fiona drove them to the nearby Ramada Pudong Airport Hotel. Inside, Fiona walked directly to the executive lounge desk, and the well-dressed man there greeted her by name. Fiona booked them into rooms. A few moments later, they all had keys and agreed to meet back in the lobby in 20 minutes. Anya arrived first, 5 minutes early, freshly showered and in a change of clothes. She'd thrown her bag onto the bed, but she'd kept her backpack. Seated on one of the chairs in the lobby, she pulled up a map site and plotted their route from the airport to the Li family flower shop.
Ready when you are.
Li Shusen's beautiful moon petals flower shop wasn't far from Guhua Park. From the passenger seat of the rental car, Anya looked out over the trees and waterways. Though she could barely see them as she passed, several red and white temples with peaked roofs sat at the ends of paved walkways or stood on stilts. The whole area looked quiet and serene, and part of her wished they were headed there instead. Fiona guided the car through the morning traffic into one of the business districts. Several of the bicyclists carried farm produce for the morning markets, and some of them even had crates of chickens on the backs of their bikes. A few minutes later, Fiona pulled onto Renmin Road and took it to their destination. Trees and single-story shops lined the street. Shoppers and tourists were already out in full force. Unlike in the United States, where strip malls and shopping areas tended to be uniform, Nanchiao Town was a mix of old and new. Miraculously, on the flower shop's block, a delivery van pulled out and left a vacant spot. Fiona claimed the space at once.
My God, I thought we were about to die.
Calm down, Professor.
Fiona took a sleek Walter PPK out of the glove compartment and tucked it into her small handbag.
I could only arrange the one, I'm afraid. I notice you don't carry a purse, Anya.
Not if I can help it.
Of course, having a sword you can pull out of thin air trumps a handbag.
It does.